The Supreme Court of Nevada is back in session.
Thank you very much. This is the time and place set for argument, or the time and virtual place set for argument, in Teva versus 8th Judicial District Court, case number 81024. You will not see Justice Perrigary's face, but he is listening on the webcast and is participating in the case. Justice Silver is not participating in the case, as I'm sure you all know. The arguments, you did file a reply brief in this case, so you have rebuttal, Mr. Polsenberg, and can you let the clerk know how much time you wish to reserve for rebuttal before you begin?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to say 5 minutes.
Very well. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Justice Pickering. May it please the court, Dan Polsenberg for petitioner. Plaintiffs argue this case as if we were back in 2010. They argue in principles of preemption that don't apply to generic drugs, and some arguments that don't work even for brand name pharmaceuticals. There were three cases that were decided since 2010 that have radically changed and defined preemption jurisprudence for generic manufacturers of pharmaceuticals. First, there was Mensing in 2011. And Mensing described the way the Hatch-Waxman amendments, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, work when we're dealing with generics. The generics have a limited role. Everybody has a role, the FDA, the branded manufacturers, and generics have a very limited role in what it is that what the label, the principle involved here is that of sameness. It has to have the same design, the same labeling. And this is what Congress did to bring life-saving drugs to the public at an affordable cost. And then in 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court decided Bartlett and soundly rejected the principle that a pharmaceutical could be liable simply for not selling the drug. In other words, not stopping selling the drug. And then last year, in 2019, the Supreme Court decided Albright and set out the procedural principles that make it clear that it's appropriate for this court to decide this case now. And since 2013, since Bartlett, courts have really taken to heart what the principles of preemption are when we're dealing with generic manufacturers. The federal decisions universally have held that preemption applies to generic drugs. And we can see that in the decisions in district and circuit courts and the MDLs, including In Re Darvocet. But you know, state courts have followed these principles as well in applying federal law, in applying Mensing and Bartlett to say that claims against generics are preempted. We can see that in Pennsylvania in the case of In Re Reglan. We can see that in California in their Trejo case, and in Iowa in the Huck opinion. Now let's go through these three cases in a little more detail. In Mensing, as I said, the U.S. Supreme Court explained Hatch-Waxman. Generic drugs, the only requirement for a generic manufacturer is that of sameness. It's got to be the bioequivalency, it has to use the same label, and it has to use the same formulation. They are not allowed, a generic drug is not allowed to modify the label in any way, which preempts a failure to warn case. And it's a delicate balance that the Hatch-Waxman Act has constructed. The FDA and the branded manufacturer are responsible for the label. They do the label, and the generic has to simply follow what that is. And that makes sense because the FDA has all the information about the drug. And even here where plaintiffs are arguing that we should have done something different when it came to outpatient clinics. The FDA had all the information, not just about propofol, but also about other anesthetics. And they approved the warning. And the warning here six times points out that it's a single-use drug and that the healthcare provider has to throw away the unused portion in the vial. And at another point, it emphasizes how to use the aseptic procedures, including using this for the vial for a single patient.
Mr. Polzenberg, Justice
Your Honor.
Hi. So I understand what you're saying about claims that allege inadequacy of labeling or inadequacy of warning on labels, but I don't read this complaint as alleging that. Do you?
Actually, I think what they've doubled down on is the stop selling argument, and that's the argument that was rejected in Bartlett.
Well, that argument was rejected in the context of a claim about an inadequate label, that stopping selling wasn't something that prevented the impossibility conflict under the preemption analysis. Right? So, but both those cases, both the Bartlett and the Mensing cases before the U.S. Supreme Court that elaborated on the preemption doctrine and how it applies to generic drug manufacturers, both arose in the context of claims about inadequate warnings on the label, did they not?
They did, but that is because that is what the FDA regulates. But it also regulates the sale. It effectively grants permission to manufacturers and distributors to sell propofol in 50 milliliter vials.
And 20 milliliter vials and other size vials.
And tens and 100s.
And so the claim here about what vial should be sold to a particular medical clinic or medical facility that does certain known procedures, how is that covered by those cases that deal with labeling?
The principle goes beyond labeling. The principle is that once the FDA allows an actor to act in a particular way, state law can't change that.
So there's immunity. A generic drug manufacturer can be liable for no state law claims. Is that your position?
No. It's a very narrow preemption. It goes to particular acts that the FDA regulates. So if there were a manufacturing defect, or if there was a claim of advertising or marketing inappropriately, then yes, there would still be liability there.
Mr. Polzenberg, this is Justice Hardesty. the test under implied preemption in Bartlett to me was whether it's impossible for the private party to comply with both state and federal requirements. Wonder if you could comment on the argument that's being made by plaintiffs that partial cessation, meaning that you would still be able to sell the 20 milliliter vial as opposed to the 50, is not the same as the stop selling rule adopted by Bartlett, which essentially was concerned with the foreclosure of the distribution of the product. Here we seem to be talking about a quantity. Now, in footnote 14 of the opening of the writ, you identify three cases where this partial cessation issue is addressed. But important to me was the Oklahoma case in Gentech. And I know that this has occurred since the petition was filed, but that has been overturned by the Tenth Circuit and reversed. And I think
it was overturned on other grounds. It was not overturned on the stop selling theory. In fact, the Tenth Circuit didn't go to the stop selling theory.
Well, it's focused on the difference in quantity and vial content. So
yes.
It seems to me that it is, to a degree, focusing on that difference. But I wonder if you could. I wonder if you could talk about that, because it seems to me like this is kind of an important issue that hasn't been addressed too much around the country. I acknowledge the cases you cite in footnote 14, but I am concerned about why partial cessation isn't that different than the stop selling rule in Bartlett.
I think it is the same thing. I think if you're saying that the United States Supreme Court only had preemption when you withdrew altogether from the market as opposed to a market segment, I think the rationale is exactly the same. Admittedly, the majority of the U.S. Supreme Court used the word altogether, but they only used it twice. And I think they used it rhetorically to explain how extreme the position is, that the only way you can avoid state law liability is to withdraw from the state. But here their argument is that, essentially their argument is, you can sell to anybody except me or people who are in my position. So in other words, it's all together versus particular circumstances.
Well, but not really. Isn't the argument, well, we'll ask Mr. Weatherall in a minute, but isn't the argument of plaintiffs at this point, you can sell all the 20 milliliter vials you want to these surgery centers, you just can't sell the 50 milliliter vials. So it seems like that's much different than taking the drug out of the marketplace, as Bartlett was concerned about.
I think the Bartlett analysis is more whether you are telling somebody who is permitted to act under federal regulation that state law prohibits that action.
But the language
is ceasing to act.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. The video sometimes causes that. Had you completed your response, Mr. Polzenberg?
Your Honor, I'm happy to have you interrupt me.
Well, the label itself, and thankfully, and I appreciate very much the fact that you folks printed a version that was readable. The other version was pretty small, but the label itself says may not shall use in the vials. The actual language I think that was focused in here is that it may be used for that purpose. So does the word may infringe on the stop selling argument?
In the label?
Yeah, I mean, there's no label change required here. It just says they may use it, but state law may say, well, not necessarily in that quantity. So I don't think that requires a label change, does it?
Well, no, the label uses must. Strict aseptic technique must always be maintained. Propofol injectable is a single-use product.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, I don't.
I guess I'm not trying to understand is if the plaintiff's argument is correct that this is a strict liability claim, and I know there's four claims, so I'm not sure whether this argument fits under each of them. Maybe some of these claims are appropriately dismissed under preemption, but focusing on the strict liability claim, what change has to be made either to the composition of the product, the label of the product, or its distribution mechanism that would bring us within the preemption in Bartlett?
Well, if state law is going to say that to comply with state law, you have to pull the product from a market segment, That's exactly what Bartlett rejected in the majority opinion. Pulling a product from the market to comply with both state and federal law is no solution. So here, state law through tort law would be regulating the extent of our activities. And that exception would swallow the rule. Any plaintiff could come up with any market segment that would say, well, you shouldn't have sold that generic drug in a way that it would get to me. And that would get to the three cases in footnote 14. The plaintiff in Raskus said that you shouldn't sell that drug to people who are suffering from nausea. In In Re Lipitor, the plaintiff said you shouldn't sell to women. And yes, in In Re Genentech, it was the size of the vial. So any of those, anybody could come up with a hypothetical argument to say you can sell to the entire world, but you can't sell to people like me.
Mr. Goldenberg, may I ask a quick question?
Yes, please, yes. Justice Stiglitz.
When you mentioned Genentech and the vial size, was there an alternative size vial, as there is in this case?
I don't believe that was the circumstance. I think the circumstance was, remember, that was a solid product that you would add 20 milliliters of pure water to. So I think the size of the vial mattered there. And I think that was the issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Paulsenberg, you have, and we have helped, used up your rebuttal time. I'm going to add 3 minutes to Mr. Weatherall's time, and you may have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Weatherall.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice Pickering. May it please the court. Your Honors have touched upon some of the issues in this case that have made my arguments for me perhaps better than I did. I'd like to start, though, with the very basic holding that exists in the Bartlett case. Bartlett said state law design defect claims that turn on the adequacy of a drug's warnings are preempted by the FDC Act and under the court's 2011 decision in Pleva. It did not say that blanket immunity is extended for all types of claims under all types of circumstances, and yet that appears to be what the defense is arguing here, that there is an impossibility preemption that essentially immunizes the defense from any type of suit under any sorts of circumstances. And we respectfully disagree and say that that's an overreach. One of the issues that you justices have touched upon is this stop selling language in Mensing. And I want to be really clear about what that language is. It says, our preemption cases presume that an actor seeking to satisfy both his federal and state law obligations is not required to cease acting altogether in order to avoid liability. So one of the issues for your honors to decide in this case is, did the U.S. Supreme Court mean what it said when it used the language cease acting altogether? Because if it didn't mean that, as counsel just suggested, if that was merely rhetorical, then my position may be wrong. But if we take this language at face value, a precondition to that impossibility preemption is that the state law or cause of action require the actor to cease acting altogether, and that is not what is being contended here. Under our theory of liability here, defendants are free to sell their propofol in Nevada. They are free to sell their propofol to ambulatory surgical centers in Nevada. They are free to sell their propofol in 10 to 20 milliliter quantities, and no withdrawal of that propofol from the market is required. Under that circumstance, again, if you take the literal language from the Bartlett case as written, that does not appear to be a stop selling requirement that's being imposed upon Teva here.
But Mr. Weatherall, this is Justice Hardesty, if I could interrupt you there.
Certainly.
As to the 50 milliliter vial, in fact, frankly, the 100 milliliter vial, because it too is allowed to be used as a single use anesthetic, those are being effectively removed from the market, at least this market, by your theory. Does that infringe? I know these cases aren't exactly on point, but they do seem to suggest the cases that I referenced in footnote 14 of the petition, with the exception of Gentech, seem to suggest that you can't have a stop selling altogether or even a stop selling to a segment of the market. What's your view on this point?
Justice Hardesty, my view is that the theory of the case here does not require a cessation of selling 50 or 100 milliliter bottles of propofol in Nevada. Those would still be able to be sold in to facilities that actually need bottles that size. For example, an actual hospital may use a 100 milliliter bottle as a single dose vial, and a hospital may use a 50 milliliter dose as a single use vial. But an ambulatory surgical center, by definition, doesn't use a 50 milliliter bottle or a 100 milliliter bottle as a single use vial, unless it is essentially throwing out all but 10 or 20 milliliters of that. So again, going back to the language, cease acting altogether, it is a very narrow restraint. And the restraint that we're talking about is not born of any issue with the product per se. The restraint that we're talking about is provoked by the aftermarket knowledge that these defendants gained in learning that despite the approved warning, despite their best efforts and intentions, that these larger bottles were in fact being used and spreading hepatitis C in ambulatory surgical centers. So under circumstances where they are armed with that knowledge, it seems to be a modest restraint to have them comport with the standards of reasonable care in deciding not to market and sell those size bottles to ambulatory surgical centers, even as they continue to do so to hospitals.
What about Mr. Polsenberg's argument that the FDA label they're selling consistent with what the FDA label says? And that's what they did. There's no showing that they sold it in for multi-use, but single use.
I don't think that circumstance makes a difference, because the restraint being sought here or the standard of care being imposed here is not to preclude them from selling or from taking those size bottles out of the marketplace, which was the fear expressed by the U.S. Supreme Court. In fact, it's a modest limitation that is provoked by knowledge that despite the best intentions and efforts with the label, there was a foreseeable misuse in a very narrow circumstance. And so if the Bartlett case is interpreted as saying cease acting in some respect or cease acting a little bit, then I believe I lose. But if we take it at face value and it requires an imposition of ceasing to act altogether, then I believe that that level of prohibition on the part of state law claims doesn't occur here.
Mr. Weatherall, this is Justice Cater. So are you asserting a claim that the warnings or labels are inadequate in some way, as was asserted in Mensing and Bartlett?
To the extent the complaint contains that, I think that that needs to fall away per Mensing and Bartlett. I don't see any way around that in the
right.
generic drug context.
Right, because they're not permitted to change their labeling or warnings unilaterally.
That's right. We can't ask them to alter the design or formulation of the product. We can't ask them to enhance the warning label. And we can't ask them to stop selling that drug altogether. And none of those things are what's being required by a common law negligence claim, for example. So while I agree that there is some teeth in Bartlett and Mensing that is applicable to this case, it does not extend to blanket immunity for every claim that's been alleged here.
So, to follow up, Mr. Weatherall, both as to Justice Kadish's question and your response, would you acknowledge then that the first cause of action for strict product liability, the second cause of action for breach of implied warranty of fitness, and the Nevada Deceptive Trade Practice Act claim under the fourth would all be dismissed under the preemption doctrine?
I'm not so sure about the deceptive trade practice claim, but I think it's inescapable that any of the claims based on failure to warn need to fall away in a generic drug context.
Okay, thank you.
The deceptive trade practice claim is obviously under state statute, and I guess liberally construed in favor of the real parties and interests, it suggests that there was a concealment of information and a misrepresentation of the safety of specifically the 50 milliliter bottle in the ambulatory surgical context that provoked, or at least was a contributing cause of the hepatitis outbreak that in turn provoked the warning letters to my clients that necessitated their getting tested and checked out for hepatitis and HIV. So there is a component of the DTPA that is arguably a failure to warn, but I think there is another component that speaks to these drug companies having greater knowledge of risks and circumstances associated with the sale of 50 milliliter bottles in ambulatory surgical centers, but setting aside any failure to warn because they can't change the label, but they could, under our theory, have made the decision to just simply stop selling that size bottle to ambulatory surgical centers. And I think that averts the failure to warn rendition that, again, results, that takes us back to Bartlett and Mensing.
Mr. Weatherall?
Yes.
Just briefly, if the FDA had not approved the 10 and 25 vials, so we only had the 50, then there'd be no cause of action here, correct? You couldn't make them break it down, be in possibility preemption, correct?
I think you're absolutely right, Justice Stiglitz. And with respect to, if I could just go back to the Genentech case that was being discussed earlier, that was a case that involved the plaintiffs seeking to prevent the formulation of that biologic drug so that it contained a certain amount of an active ingredient. I don't believe it had to do with the size of the bottle. I think it had to do with the amount of active ingredient in there. And they were suggesting that you needed to stop selling versions of that didn't have this very limited amount of active ingredient. That's a different circumstance. This case stands, I wish I had better case law for you that just undisputably proved my point, but there are aspects of this case factually that make it kind of a unicorn, because we're not suing for contracting hepatitis from a drug. We're suing for conduct, negligent conduct, arguably, which provoked notices that reasonable persons responded to by incurring medical expenses and incurring fear. And that's that at its core is the theory of the case here and why we believe it should go forward. Thank you.
And so then, I'm sorry, this may be reiterating or repeating what we've discussed already, but given the case law we have, your request for relief now, I guess, is, well, no, that's wrong. The asserted improper activity that would lead to liability is continuing to sell 50 milliliter vials to ambulatory surgical centers, given what they came to know about the risk of reuse or likelihood of reuse in those contexts.
That's correct.
Okay.
Unless there's further questions, I'll submit on that.
Thank you very much. Are there further questions in Carson City?
No, thank you.
No.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Weatherall. Mr. Posenberg, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me go back in discussing the Bartlett market segment issue. Let me go back to what Mensing talked about. Mensing talked about how the FDA is the party that has all the information. There isn't a situation where a generic has advanced knowledge. The generic only does, instead of a new drug application, it does an abbreviated new drug application. And all it has to monitor are adverse events as a result of its own particular drug, and it has to guarantee sameness. The FDA knows about these instances with some clinics. The FDA did a report on some facilities in 2007. The FDA was in a position where it could have said, all right, stop selling 50 milliliters and 100 milliliters to ambulatory care centers. But it didn't. We are approved to sell the 50 milliliters without restriction.
But Mr. Posenberg, does that mean that they're required by federal law to sell 50 milliliter or 100 milliliter to those type facilities?
Well, we're not required in the sense that we would have to do this, but we're also allowed to. And so we would be, by selling the 50 milliliters to endoscopy centers, we're complying with federal law.
But and like, unlike the situation where a generic drug manufacturer cannot unilaterally change the label, that is clear, but they can unilaterally choose not to sell a particular size to a particular type medical facility, can they not?
But the issue isn't whether they can decide not to act. The issue is whether they're allowed to act in compliance with federal law. And that was the point in Bartlett. By saying you have to cease to act creates impossibility. It is incompatible with our preemption jurisdiction. And I don't think it makes a material difference whether it's a market or market segment. As I said earlier, that exception swallows the rule, because for any generic drug now, you can make the argument, well, you shouldn't have sold to this particular market segment. And Mr. Weatherall jumps on the word altogether. He even says he's quoting it from page 2 and 3 of our petition, but the word didn't appear there, and it only appeared in Bartlett 2 times. The majority in Bartlett talks about stop selling, market withdrawal, cease acting. They use those phrases repeatedly throughout a lengthy opinion. And to jump on a word that's used sparsely simply misses the point. Essentially, what we would be doing by having state law put another restriction here, we would be second-guessing the FDA. And that's improper.